I don't know about you, but I sometimes I struggle to dream God-sized dreams. And yet you look at history, you look at people who really did change the world for the kingdom of God, and they had crazy dreams, exciting ideas, things that they asked God to do repeatedly, faithfully, passionately, and God did them. So I think as I prepared for this message this week, and just even singing this morning and just preaching at the first service, I was just reminded how little faith I think I really do have at times. You know, when Jesus says, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you could say to that mountain, move, and it will go. I think about that, I'm like, boy, you know, the mustard seed was an interesting choice because not only is it a tiny little seed, I have a picture somewhere of a mustard seed. It's like you can barely, it looks like a tiny little gnat that you killed in your palm. That's how small it is. And yet, the sort of the other side of the mustard seed story with Jesus was not only the size of your faith, but like when that is planted to a farmer, the mustard plant was a weed. You plant one mustard seed, and the mustard trees that grew would overwhelm a countryside. In fact, I was down near the Jordan River when I spent some time in Israel, and our guide pointed to mustard trees. And he's like, this is destroying the shoreline. Mustard seeds, if you plant a mustard seed and it waters, it takes over. It's an uncontrollable plant that overwhelms the country. Isn't that a beautiful picture to think about? If you have faith the size of a mustard seed, not only is it tiny on our part, but God can do incredible things that can't be controlled through that. So I love thinking about that. As we dive into today's passage in the book of Acts chapter 12, let's keep that in mind. I need to keep that in mind too because I think I've met a lot of people in my time and I feel like even people who are marginally religious, not to mention those who walk with God faithfully and passionately, everyone's got something they're asking God to do in their life. Whether it be a sick relative they want to see restored or whether it's just they've lost their job and they're desperate to the soldier in the foxhole during World War II as the bullets were flying. The old statement, the old adage is there's no atheists in foxholes. That when the bullets are flying, even the person who's most far from God asks God to save their life and make some pretty crazy promises in the moment. So I think about that. I think about in my life, I think, what are some of the big things that I've prayed for that I've asked God to do? And what's amazing is when I look at what those things were, or I look at people that have prayed certain prayers, I realize that in each of these three examples I'm going to give you, God answered exactly what was asked for. But God being God, he didn't answer it the way we expected him to. In fact, how often do we see God do something miraculous that we may have even been praying for, but we're very quick to credit doctors. We're very quick to credit technology. We're very quick to credit healthy lifestyles or good choices or fortune or luck or whatever it may be, when there's often times that the only explanation is that God did something miraculous. And I'm guilty of that as well. In about around the year 2000 or so, my mom and dad had moved from Pennsylvania to Memphis, Tennessee. My dad's job changed, and so he got transferred down there. And I remember my mom calling me on the phone, and she's like, I just feel so useless. I feel like God is not using me for anything. You know, they were attending a church in their town that was the second largest church. It had 14,000 people in it. And the further, a little further down the street was Adrian Rogers Church. It had like 25 to 28,000 people. So they wanted the smaller one, which I thought was interesting. But so they're attending a church with more people than that currently reside in Fulton. And they were there, and she just said, you know, I feel like I'm just not doing it. God's not using me. I want to have an impact. I want to do something. I want my life to matter. I want to count. I want to make a difference in people's lives. And so she prayed and we prayed together. God, use her to do something great with her life for your kingdom. And what's amazing is about, you know, we sort of look back at her life 6 years later and we thought, my goodness, from that point on, when she really offered her life as a living sacrifice to God, God used her to lead 15 people to Christ that she knew of, which is exciting and powerful. So God answered that prayer. And then I think about Angela and I when we were first married. I remember kneeling at the foot of our bed when we lived above the Ron Lee's insurance office where a train went by every night at 4 a.m. and the cars flew right past or right on the road. And I remember kneeling at the foot of the bed one night, and we were just praying, saying, God, show us what you want to do with our lives. We want to be in ministry. We are willing to go wherever you want us to go. Do whatever you want us to do. And God led us to Minnesota for 5 years, and then to Michigan, the suburbs of Detroit for 5 years, and then the center of Detroit for a year. And then God led us to Central New York. So God answered that prayer. God sent us different places for his glory. I think of several of you at Calvary that have been here for a long time. I remember Todd Wells, who's been in this church for several years. And he was sharing on a Sunday night at the prayer meeting, just talking about how excited he was at what God's been doing in the church, how it's been growing, and how we've been reaching the area, and exciting things have been happening. He said, I just remember sitting in these prayer meetings and praying that God would bring people to this church, praying that God would grow it, praying that God would reach a younger generation, young families, and how exciting that was to see that fulfillment, to see God really moving and God really reaching and growing, and to see just worshiping with all of you right now. For some of you, I pray that was an exciting fulfillment of a prayer request you've had for so long. So we see all around us, I think of these three examples, I'm like, we prayed something and God answered it. But because God is God, he didn't answer those requests the way we would have laid it out probably. But if you want to turn with me to Acts chapter 12, that's where we are this morning. And where we are in the book of Acts, last week we talked about Peter having a vision from God and then going and preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ to a Gentile audience. And Peter being amazed that God was going to save not only the Jewish people, but also Gentiles. So that really connected with me because that's my salvation. That's my story. That because of God's grace and love for all mankind, I can call myself a child of God. So Peter's coming off that exciting moment. The end of Acts chapter 11, we hear about some things that were happening in Antioch, and that was the first place that followers of Jesus were called Christians, and it was a term of derision, it was a term of mockery. It was saying, oh, you're just like a little Christ, you're like a little Jesus. That's where that term emerged from, was in that time, that place. So at the start of Acts chapter 12, we've got the temperature of persecution starting to be turned back up again. It had died down for a little bit because Saul converted to Christianity. He was sort of the chief persecutor. But now, in Acts 11 and 12, the flames are being turned up again of persecution. It's amazing to see what God does. Now, there's a Herod mentioned at the beginning of Acts chapter 12. I want to explain really quickly who this Herod was. So, if you read through the Gospels and stuff, you see that name Herod a lot. And Herod was not ageless. He was not immortal. Herod in this culture was kind of like Pharaoh or Caesar, where you've got several guys with the title of Caesar or Pharaoh. So this one today, you know, had Herod the Great, who built the temple and who was the one who was searching for Jesus desperately in the Christmas story. That was Herod the Great. This today, we're going to look at Herod Agrippa, a relative of Herod the Great. Herod Agrippa was an especially savory character, sarcasm intended. He went to school in Rome, and his classmates were future Caesars. He actually was a schoolmate and friend of Claudius, who ended up being a Caesar someday. And so his training and education was thoroughly Greco-Roman. And so history tells us that when he was in Rome, he partied like the Roman. When in Rome, he coined that. No, I don't know if he did or not, but when he was in Rome, he was thoroughly enjoying the Roman lifestyle. But when he returned to Jerusalem, he was devout. He was dedicated. In fact, there's a story of him weeping openly at the reading in Deuteronomy that talked about no foreigner could ever lead the Jewish people, and he was an Edomite, so he wasn't of the chosen few, and he was weeping at his disqualification, and the people were so moved by his emotion that they said, no, you're our brother, you can lead us, we love you. And so he did what it took in different settings to fit in and to lead. So Herod Agrippa now wants the popularity in Jerusalem. He wants to be beloved. He wants to be popular. And so in Acts chapter 12, verse 1, we've got the story of what he's doing to gain the favor of the people. Acts 12, verse 1 says, about that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. This was during the days of unleavened bread. And when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out to the people. So Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. Don't you love that little line right there? It's saying he was in prison. It was a bad state. He was trapped. They doubled the guards, 16 guards around him, but the church was praying to God passionately for his release. So here's the setting. We've got Herod grabbing James. Now, this is James. Remember Peter, James, and John were the inner circle of Jesus' disciples? This was one of the sons of thunder. He was there for Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. I mean, he was one of the center three, one of the chief students. And so Herod grabs James and has him beheaded, and the people were pleased. The people were excited that they were stamping out this rebellion. And so when they saw that, Herod Agrippa is like, well, if they liked how we dealt with James, give me Peter. Give me the big kahuna. Give me the big name. Give me the pillar. Give me the one who preached the message in Acts 2. Give me the one that's the head of this whole deal. Bring me Peter. And so it's interesting because this is the week of Passover. It's Passover week. And if you think about it, when was Jesus arrested? When was Jesus brought before the people? And then when was Jesus executed? Right during that Passover time. So here is Herod looking at an earlier playbook of another Herod and the Romans and saying, you know what, let's bring somebody out. Maybe he's imagining in his mind, I need a Barabbas type and I need Peter and I'm going to push him out and give them the violent criminal and I'm going to arrest and execute the one who's innocent. Maybe in his mind he's thinking, I can make this happen just like it happened before. But it's interesting because you look at Peter and you look at what happens here, and Peter is different now. Peter has changed. Peter has become a new man. Peter has learned from his past mistakes. Because if you remember when Jesus was in the garden and Jesus was praying, Peter and the others fell asleep. And then when Judas brought the soldiers to arrest Jesus, what did Peter do when they came to try to grab him? Pulled out his knife, attacked the high priest's servant, cut off his ear, and then he ran for his life like everyone else. And then Peter followed at a distance, trying to stay anonymous in the high priest's courtyard while Jesus' trial was going on. And he was identified in that moment by a servant girl who recognized the inflection of his voice. And when asked if he was one of Jesus' disciples, what did he say? Nope. Three times he denied. And then he ran off. So for Peter, how is he going to be handling seeing James, his friend, one of the disciples, killed, and then they come for him? Was he going to fight again and run? Was he going to deny Jesus and hide? How is he going to respond? We have no evidence of Peter resisting at all. It just says they grabbed him violently and threw him into prison. Let's keep going. Verse 6. Now when Herod was about to bring him out on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. So let's just pause there for a second. This is the night before. Peter knows this is the night before he's going to be brought out, tried, and executed. Do you think you'd be able to sleep soundly the night before that? I think I'd be up praying. I'd be up worrying. I'd be up thinking. I mean, if I have a big moment, like I have a fear of not hearing my alarm, it's well-founded. It's very well found. There were years that the alarm was just sort of a suggestion that I ignored in my subconscious. So now, like when I go to sleep and I've got something really big happening in the morning, I've got 5 alarms set on my phone. So 6 o'clock, 6:01, 6:02, 6:03, 6:04, 6:05. And, which Ange pointed out this morning, I also set the sleep timer on my television in our room. Only on Sunday mornings it turns on at 6 a.m. So the first thing Anne says to me is, honey, why is the TV on? And I was just completely like, what? TV? Why? So for me, I get nervous if I just have like a normal commitment in the morning that I don't sleep well. I wake up every hour and I'm looking at the clock and I don't know if anyone else suffers from that. But Peter apparently didn't. Peter knew the next day he was going to die. How was Peter able to sleep soundly the night before he was to be executed? And it says here that the guard was doubled, so he's chained on either side. He's got soldiers. There's double soldiers at the door. There's 16 soldiers in all. So in your mind, picture every movie where you've got this high-profile criminal that always breaks out of prison, you know, probably starring Nicolas Cage because he's in every other movie made these days. But anyway, so walking to his jail cell with all of these soldiers heavily armed around him, like he goes in maximum security. This whole thing was built for him. That's Peter. And the night before, on death row, he is sound asleep. How could he have that sort of peace? I think what's amazing is that Peter knew that this was not how it was going to end. Peter knew that Jesus had made a promise to him about the way he was going to die. In John chapter 21, when Jesus restores Peter on the shore and he says, Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And Peter says, you know I love you. You know I love you. You know I love you. He says then, when you're old, when you are old, you're going to be led where you don't want to go and your arms are going to be stretched out and you're going to die for me. And in parentheses in the text it says, this indicated how Peter was going to die. And the early church believed that when Peter was old, he was going to be crucified. So Peter, sitting in jail between these guards, is sitting there going, I don't know how this is going to happen, but I'm not old enough to die. I'm not old enough. This is too soon. Jesus said, when I'm old, I'm going to be crucified. This is not how it's going to end. So guess what? I'm going to sleep because I'm probably not going to wake up here. So he went to sleep. Can you imagine? Think about the kind of faith that that is. He believed more in the promise of God than in the overwhelming present circumstances that told him something completely different. He had more faith that Jesus was going to come through in his promise than on the 16 guards around him and a power and hungry, thirsty king who couldn't wait to make an example of him through his death. That's incredible. I think, too, what's running through Peter's mind is what happened in Luke chapter 22. Remember when Jesus said to Peter, he says, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked for you to sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and when you return, you will strengthen the brothers. And Peter said in that moment, no, Lord, I will suffer for you. I will never deny you. I will go to prison and I will even die for you. And Jesus then says, tonight, you're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows. But think about those words that he said to him. Satan's going to sift you like wheat. And anyone who knows that process, you know, the way they sifted wheat was they cut it down and then they'd throw it up in the air and the chaff would float away and the kernel of wheat would fall. So that's a violent process. You're cut down, you're dropped, you're thrown in the air, and the chaff blows away. So Peter's gone through this process, and the words of Jesus have got to be ringing in his ear. You're not going to die until you're old, and Satan's going to sift you like wheat. Don't lose faith in me. It's powerful. So here's how God does the impossible in Peter's life. Look at verse 7. And behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to Peter, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him, saying, get up quickly. And the chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, dress yourself and put on your sandals. And he did so. And he said to him, wrap your cloak around you and follow me. And he went out and followed him. He did not know what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. Verse 10, when they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city. It opened for them of its own accord, and they went out along one street, and immediately the angel left him. So just to get back into that moment, it says that when the angel arrived, you would think the bright light of the angel would wake him up. I know some of you, like, if you're asleep and the door opens or your kid comes in and flicks on the big light at like 2:30 in the morning, it's like, for me, I just kind of wake up right away. But here, it says that the angel struck Peter in the side to wake him up. So this was sort of like the boot in the ribs wake up. Just the kicking, not the gentle, Peter, buddy, it's time to get up, sweetie. Come on, pal. We're going to Disney today. There's no school. It's a snow day. We're going to go outside and sled. I've got pancakes ready. Sorry, never talk about food at 11:30. I keep forgetting that rule. Okay, forget the pancakes. Just coffee. You'd think it would be an angel. It would be some angelic awakening. But Peter was so out cold, it took the angel kicking him in the side. That word for struck there in other passages is like smite, like killed, like a forceful wailing in the ribs. So it was like not the gentle awakening of your mom on a vacation day to go outside and enjoy your time with your family. This is more like you're the last one sleeping at a teenage boy's sleepover and everyone wakes you up together, which has happened to some of us. Don't ever be that guy. Be the first one up and you can control your destiny. Anyway, so he's awakened and the chains fall off and he gets dressed and the angel's like, shh, they're all still sleeping. Walks out. He's outside. He gets all the way to the gate. The gate opens and he leads him right outside of a house. Verse 11, when Peter came to himself or found himself, now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting. And when he realized this, he went straight to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. So let's stop there. Remember what it said in verse 5? So Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was being made to God by the church. So when he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John Mark, and the people were praying, what were they praying for specifically in that moment? They're praying for Peter to be released from prison. James had just been beheaded. This church was shaken. They were heartbroken. They were afraid, but they were on their knees all night. This says it's the middle of the night. They are praying all night long. It says earnest prayer. That same word for earnest before the word prayer there is the word that was used in the passage of Luke, in Luke 22, where it says that Jesus was praying so earnestly that his sweat was like drops of blood in the garden. Same word. They were passionately crying out to God to rescue Peter, and now Peter is standing outside the prayer meeting where they were praying for him to be released. So, we have an expectation of how this is going to go. But listen to what actually happens. Verse 13, and when Peter knocked at the door of the gateway, a servant girl came named Rhoda. She recognized Peter's voice, and in her joy, she did not open the gate and let him inside, but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. So she's so excited. Again, here's a servant girl. Remember in Jesus' account, who identified Peter as being one of Jesus' followers? Servant girl. Here in this account, who recognizes Peter first? A servant girl. But instead of Peter denying Jesus and running for his life, now Peter's like, I'm Peter, let me in. But she's so excited. Without letting him inside, she runs into the prayer meeting. So picture us all right now praying for something miraculous to happen, praying for one of your, let's say we're praying for your dad to come to church for the first time, or we're praying, we're like, we're really going to focus on Cliff's relative, Cliff's dad. We're going to pray and pray and pray that he comes. And all of a sudden, someone comes running to the door and says, Cliff's dad is outside. He's here. Would we not be like, wow, that's unbelievable. He drove here from Grand Rapids, and my dad loves Jesus. That's not the story. And he'll listen to this. Dad, I know that you love God, so he listens to the podcast after. Anyway, so we'd be excited. We'd be like, my goodness, God did it. How exciting is that? But yet, what did they do in this moment? Verse 15, they said to her, you are out of your mind. You're crazy. What are you talking about? But she kept insisting it was so. And they kept saying, maybe it's his angel or a ghost. You're seeing a ghost. It's his angel. But Peter continued knocking. Now here's the most wanted man in all of Jerusalem, finally jailbroken, and he's standing on the street in the middle of the night like, can I just get off the street, please? In about 5 minutes, there's going to be a horde of soldiers looking for me. Can I just get inside this prayer meeting where you're kind of thinking and praying for me? I think it's so amazing because it's easy for me to point to this story and be like, these people were so just shallow. What's wrong with them? How could they not see God's hand? Yet how often have I done the same thing? How often has God's miraculous hand worked something out exactly the way we prayed? And I'm like, wow, that's a good doctor. Oh my goodness, how could those doctors have missed those tests? How could they have missed Angela's gout in her wrist? All this time we went to every doctor. Boy, that one doctor who finally caught it was really good. Instead of being like, no, we've prayed for 4 years that God would help Angela to walk, and now God has done it. And instead of saying every other reason it could be except to say, thank you, God, you are the God of the impossible, and you have healed my wife, I say it's a ghost. I say you're out of your mind, you're crazy. And I'm quick to credit every other avenue of possibility and believe things that actually require more faith than just believing that God did it. Isn't it amazing? It actually takes less for us to be like, praise God, Peter's out of prison. He answered our prayer. Instead of being like, well, there's a belief that circulated in the first century that every person has a guardian angel. And when they die, that guardian angel for 3 days hovers over their body until the stone is fully sealed. And at that point, then they're fully dead. So they must be believing that Peter was put to death in the middle of the night and his guardian angel's just coming to tell us. That's what they meant by it's his angel or it's his ghost. That takes a lot of leaps, doesn't it? Rather than saying, we're praying for Peter to be released and he's here. But Peter continued knocking, verse 16. When they opened, they saw him and were amazed, astonished, beside themselves. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, shh, I'm still a fugitive. He described to them how the Lord had brought him out of prison. And then he said, tell these things to James and to the brothers. Then he departed and went to another place. Now the James here is obviously not the one that was just put to death. This is James, the brother of Jesus, who is now the head of the Jerusalem church. He wants James to know, tell him how God rescued me miraculously because I've got to get out of town because there's going to be a manhunt. What I love is that James, the brother of Jesus, wrote a book, the book of James. And he was the one who said, the fervent or passionate or continued prayer of a righteous person availeth much. He knew that firsthand. And when we pray, God moves. I love that. James knew this story and he put that in his book so that we would never, ever forget it. I think what's amazing about this whole concept here for me as I think about it today is that I pray for things and I ask God to do things, but I want him to do things the way that I envision them being fulfilled. When I prayed with my mom that God would use her to make an impact, and God answered that miraculously, what I didn't realize is that he was going to give her stage 4 brain and lung cancer, and she was going to lead people to Christ while wasting away physically. But yet she would tell you right now if she was here that she is grateful to God. She said that cancer was her platform for ministry. It gave her a voice to share. That is not what I was praying for, I promise you. In fact, if someone prays that way with you, you almost want to like push him or punch him. Like, stop, no. Don't pray that God gives me cancer. What's wrong with you? Pray that God uses me in some very just simple way. But that's not the God we serve. The God we serve says, I'm going to use you, and I'm going to use you in a powerful way, and here's how I'm going to do it. When Angie and I prayed that God would send us anywhere and that we were willing to go, we didn't realize what that would look like at each stop. We thought we would just get a magical angelic messenger being like, here's your next assignment. Good job. See you later. Not using a heartbreak and hurt and pain and suffering to open and close doors. God still answered, but he didn't answer it the way we expected. And you think about this church, many of you that prayed for years that God would grow this church and that it would be relevant in the community, that young people would come and that we'd see just an impact around us. And we're praying for that, and you're praying for that, and you're praying for that. And then when it happens, you're like, yeah, but I didn't want these things to change. But that's what God was going to use to make those things happen. So it's almost like be careful what you pray for, because we serve a God of the impossible. And he puts us through things to make us ready for those answers. I wasn't ready for kids when I started praying for kids. In some ways, I'm still not ready for kids. But God took us through a journey and a process, but we prayed and we prayed and we prayed, but he had to change my heart first. I think sometimes I don't dream big enough for God. I think sometimes I pray in bite-sized, achievable areas where it's maybe just beyond my grasp. I can kind of do it if God helps me. I read a quote by Spurgeon recently that said, be bold. He was talking to pastors. Be bold in your preaching. Be bold in calling people to give their lives to Christ. Because when we lower the bar, we're insulting God. We're lowering him to the level of our unbelief. That was great for me to read. I'm like, wow, so I don't believe strongly enough. That's awesome to read right before Easter Sunday. That was great to be reminded. I can't lower God to my level. I need to pray big prayers, dream big dreams, knowing that he can and will and wants to do it. So I think about this, and I think about where we are. And I just want to encourage each of you to pray believing that God can do it. What is a big dream that you have for God? What is a big request? But recognizing that God's timetable is not ours. Recognizing it may not happen in 6 months. It may not happen in a month. It may happen in 40 years. Wow, that's hard to hear. But remember God's way of telling time? A day is like 1,000 years. Man, if we talk about 1 year at Calvary being 5 years anywhere else because of all that God's been doing here, 1 day with God is like 1,000 years. That's unbelievable. What are you praying for? What are you asking God for?